I live in Northern Idaho, in Boundary County, Idaho, the northernmost county of the state. When I'm driving to the small town that serves as the county seat of Boundary County, known as Bonner's Ferry, sometimes instead of taking the main road, I like to go on the old road before the main US 95 highway was built. I like to drive down into the tiny little township of Naples and drive northwards along the old road. And you get into the area that is very flat, the Deep Creek Valley. It's just very, very flat, all the way across a deep creek running through it. And before too long, you arrive at the dike that's the levee rather that's bounding the Kootenai River as the Kootenai River flows. First of all, it's flowing westwards, and then it turns to flow northwards because it's going to go eventually over the border into Canada to join the Columbia River in Canada, just over the border. So this flat area next to the river is clearly glacial. I mean, it's an area that once upon a time, large ice sheets covered. And you can tell that by the fact that there are glacial moraines left. At the edge of a glacier, if the glacier is retreating, as many of the world's glaciers are at the moment, then you will see a pile of stones, the moraine that's left by the glacier. And you can see these moraines in this flat bottom valley, little tiny hills of stones. And many of those have been used because they're grass covered, and some of the farmhouses that have been built in this very fertile part of Idaho are built on top. And it's glacial. So does that mean that there was an ice age? Does that mean that what we get taught in public schools about the earth, the northern areas of the earth being covered with glaciers a couple of million years ago, is that true? In which case, everything that I've been telling you about the book of Genesis doesn't work, does it? This is the Paul Taylor Podcast. And if you're saying that you know truth, if you're saying that you know what is truth, then you've got to have something to actually measure that against.
Paul Taylor Podcast.
25 feet, 1,000 layers. How many millions of years did that take to form then? The answer is it took 3 hours.
Paul Taylor Podcast.
This is the Paul Taylor Podcast, written, presented and produced by me, Paul Taylor, through Proverbs 18:10 Media. You can find out more information, including the RSS feed necessary for your favorite podcast software, at proverbs1810.org. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the Paul Taylor Podcast, episode 29. I've been taking quite a while to cover the early chapters of Genesis with you, and this is foundational to everything that we need to understand about the world. And we come to a little point now where the science at first sight doesn't seem to work with Genesis. We're talking about glacial areas. You can see glaciation in lots of different parts of the world where there's no glaciation today. It's very, very obvious indeed where I live, and I live in northern Idaho, and just in that introduction to the podcast, I talked about the glacial moraines and so on, the evidence that that area was once covered with ice. Now, was that something that happened millions of years ago? And is there anything that we can learn about this from the Bible? When I wrote my book, Don't Miss the Boat, I talked about glaciation I had a whole chapter on the Ice Age. And I'm going to try and summarise some of the points from that chapter in this podcast. You see, the evidence certainly is there that there was an Ice Age. And in my book, Don't Miss the Boat, I put a photograph of Malham Tarn. This is a cliff face overlooking the Yorkshire town of Malham. And you see the evidence of glaciation there. And in fact, this looks like a huge waterfall. And because that is almost certainly what it was. It's a cliff. Now, of course, you go to the top of the cliff, and there's a public footpath there, and it's dry on the top of the cliff today. But nevertheless, you can see the places where the water must have flowed, where it must have thundered over this limestone cliff. On the other hand, if you're down at the bottom of the cliff, there is a stream, and you walk up to the cliff edge, and you can see that the stream is emerging from the bottom of the cliff. The water has soaked through the limestone, and so we're getting that beautiful water coming out there. And I do apologise, I think I called it Malham Tarn. That's something different, that's a hill. This is Malham Cove is what I'm looking for. If you're in England and you're looking for the particular place, it's a favourite walking point of mine. I first saw this on a geography field trip when I was in high school. And the interesting thing was I wasn't studying geography at the time, but nevertheless, I was able to go along with this. The strange way that our school did things was that you learned either geography or chemistry. So it's a rather odd way of doing things. It would make sense today, really, to be able to do both for many people. But anyway, that's getting off the subject. The point is that glaciers, modern-day glaciers, will leave behind piles of debris, and they're known as moraines. And there are two well-known types of moraines. One's known as terminal moraines, and they build up at the end of a glacier. A glacier is a river of ice, if you like. It's a slow-moving ice, but it's flowing downhill like a river would, but it's flowing slowly. So you get terminal moraines that build up at the end of the glacier, and if the glacier retreats somewhat because it's melted, because maybe the weather is getting, the climate rather is getting warmer, then you're going to get some of that rock left adrift, the stones left adrift. You also get lateral remains, and they build up at the sides of the glacier, and you can often find lateral moraines in a lot of places where there are no glaciers today. Glen Eila in Scotland would be one example. And you also get features like U-shaped valleys. A valley carved out by a stream, a fast-running stream, would be V-shaped. But you get U-shaped valleys, and they're not going to have been carved by a stream, although probably a stream carved a V-shaped valley to begin with, but then it's got filled with glaciers during a period of glaciation, during a period of ice, and the landscape has been carved out by icy glaciers. Does that fit with what the Bible teaches? Have we hit upon something here that really doesn't make sense? You see, if we concede that there was an ice age, an actual ice age, does that mean that we can't really accept the worldwide flood? And if we can't accept the worldwide flood, then everything we're talking about with the Bible falls apart. Well, that's actually not the case. Although the Bible doesn't specifically mention the Ice Age, it hints at it. And, of course, the early books of the Bible were being written in an area where there wouldn't have been much ice and snow. So we don't really expect the Bible account to talk about an ice age, but it fits with scientific principles that we develop from a presupposition that the Bible is true. A friend of mine called Michael Ord has done a lot of research on modelling how the ice age makes sense in a biblical worldview. And he's written a lot of very interesting scientific papers on the subject, also written a couple of popular level books that mention the Ice Age, and there's probably no creationist who's written more on the subject than he has, although there are other people who've commented on it as well. But I would, anyone who wants to study this further, you know, some people think I sort of gloss over a lot of science in these talks. And of course, the answer to that is yes, I do, because I'm not trying to blind you with science. I'm trying to explain to you in a popular style that you can accept the science. But I would direct you to the research that's been done by Michael Ord and his books if you want to delve into this more deeply and understand exactly how an ice age could have happened. Well, the ice age would have been nothing unusual because we've got ice today. There's ice and glaciation around the poles. You've got two huge ice sheets in the world. The biggest of all, of course, is Antarctica, where you've got an entire continent covered mostly with ice, and the ice extending over some of the sea as well. But it's mostly land there. Now, the Arctic is covered with ice as well, but that's the sea that's frozen up. But there is an ice sheet there in Greenland, so there are two main ice sheets in the world today. And the point is that those ice sheets must have extended further south at some point in time. We've talked about the fact that there is evidence for them. We've talked about the U-shaped valleys. We've talked about the moraines and so on. So, and it would seem because there's more land in around the north than there is around the south. Of course, you've got Antarctica around the South Pole, but then you've not got a huge amount of land then until you get to warmer climes. The closest bit of land to the South Pole that is not Antarctica is the southern end of South America. But you've got land closer to the North Pole than that. You've got large areas of Canada, Alaska, northern Russia, and islands, areas within the Arctic Circle, parts of Norway, of course, and then islands, and of course Greenland we've talked about. Now, if there were an ice age, to form an ice age, you would have had to have had a huge amount of precipitation at aerial temperatures that are low enough to form snow. And this is how Mike suggests that the ice age could have developed from one of his books on the subject. He says this: crustal movements would have released hot water from the Earth's crust along with volcanism, large underwater lava flows, which would have added heat to the ocean. Earth movement and rapid flood currents would have then mixed the warm water so that after the flood, the oceans would be warm from pole to pole. There would be no sea ice. A warm ocean would have had much higher evaporation than the present cool ocean surface. Much of that evaporation would have occurred at mid and high altitudes close to the developing ice sheets, so that would drop the moisture onto the cold continent. This is a recipe for powerful and continuous snowstorms that can be estimated using basic meteorology. Therefore, to cause an ice age, rare conditions are required. Warm oceans for high precipitation, cool summers for lack of melting the snow, only then can it accumulate into an ice sheet. Now, Mike Ord knows exactly what he's talking about because during his career, he's retired now, but during his career, he was a meteorologist. That was his profession. So he knows that of which he talks. Now, warmer than present oceans evaporating extensively into a cooler than present atmosphere is the recipe for the ice age. You can go and look at Mike's more detailed scientific peer-reviewed articles to show that there are calculations on the current thickness of ice in polar regions that it wouldn't actually have taken millions of years to form. All the ice in polar regions could have built up in less than 500 years on his model of this rapid production of snow and ice after the worldwide flood. Now, secular geologists say that the ice age would have needed to last for hundreds and thousands of years, and that it had to be millions of years ago. And of course, they also talk about more than one ice age. The one they refer to as the ice age, they say it's the most recent one, that they dated a couple of million years ago, but then they say there must have been earlier ice ages. Mike Ord shows that there must have been just one ice age. And if his post-flood model is used, then the ice would already have been on retreat after 200 years. The ice age, therefore, would have lasted in total no longer than 700 years. We're reminded again that secular scoffers have willfully ignored the evidence of the flood.
just as we read in 2 Peter chapter 3. And we've mentioned that on these podcasts a number of times. As I said, the Bible was written in areas that wouldn't have been greatly affected by the Ice Age. But nevertheless, there is a bit of circumstantial evidence for the Ice Age in the book of Job. Now, the book of Job is probably the earliest book to have been written in the Bible. To have been written down earlier but even than the Pentateuch. It seems very likely that Job was somebody living somewhere in the Middle East, but not in present-day Canaan, at a time not very long after the flood. And when God is speaking to Job, he's speaking to him about things that Job obviously knows and experiences. So in Job chapter 38, verses 29 and 30, we read, "From whose womb comes the ice? And the frost of heaven, who gives it birth? The waters harden like stone, and the surface of the deep is frozen." Well, it's probable that where Job lived was somewhere in the Fertile Crescent today, Mesopotamia area. And icy features like that, you wouldn't get them today, but they're mentioned there in the book of Job. So it's given you a bit of circumstantial evidence that the world's climate was colder at the time that the book of Job was written. Well, what about these multiple ice ages then that secular geologists talk about? There were early catastrophists like Georges Cuvier. He believed that Noah's flood was simply the most recent in a whole series of global floods to swept the earth. And, you've got secular geologists saying the same sort of thing about ice ages. Well, Michael Ord's book, where he explains the flood in terms that, non-scientists can understand, is called Frozen in Time. And he showed that the evidence for earlier ice ages can actually be explained by the one ice age, once we understand that its conditions, the post-flood conditions, were pretty unique, though not to be repeated. Again, a quote from his book, he says, "It seems that geologists have developed too strong a bias towards ancient ice ages to seriously consider other mechanisms for the observed rocks. The very dynamic Genesis flood produced rapid sedimentation and landslides of unstable sediments. These landslides could duplicate the large scale of some of these tillitites. Landslides would be caused by tectonic motion and huge earthquakes that occurred during the flood. It's known that the larger the landslides, the farther they travel. Hence, monstrous flood landslides are bound to cause some unconsolidated sediments to slide long distances and come to rest on nearly level strata, as is observed in these supposed ancient ice age deposits." Now, this would have had some important effects, particularly as the ice age itself ended. So the ice age is, the model we've got then is that the ice age was caused by the flood, by the conditions after the flood. Once again, let's just reiterate these two simple conditions that you can get the hang of. The ocean would have been somewhat warmer than it is today, and therefore would have evaporated more rapidly than the ocean does today. On the other hand, the atmosphere would have been cooler than it is today. A model that I know that Mike doesn't quite accept, but which makes sense to me, and I've talked about in these talks, is the catastrophic plate tectonic model. And under that model, you would expect the atmosphere to have volcanic sols in it after the flood. And so that's blotting out the sun a little bit, and you've got a cooler atmosphere, therefore. Warm precipitation going up, evaporation from the ocean going up into cold atmosphere is producing the precipitation that would fall as snow onto the earth and cause the ice. But towards the end of the Ice Age then, that biblical model makes sense. What would have happened towards the end? First of all, we have already talked about the fact that as the waters retreated from the flood, there would have been lakes held back. There are some creationists, again, I must emphasize, not all. You can't expect all creationists to hold the same scientific views. We hold the same biblical views. We all believe the Bible is true, but our models to try and explain things are going to be slightly different. So I have explained that some creationists would suggest that the Grand Canyon, for example, was carved out by a lake of floodwater that was retained and then was able to run away. The Snake River Canyon in southern Idaho was probably carved similarly as Lake. I wouldn't have been Lake Idaho. It would have been. I've forgotten the name of it now. That's the trouble with trying to sort of talk these things off the top of your head. There would have been a post-flood lake beginning with B. And I've just forgotten the name of it. But after Lake Idaho drained away, you've got this flat area then in southern Idaho. But then this other lake would have broken away and it's carved the Snake Canyon through the bed of Lake Idaho, so you've got that canyon there, and Snake Canyon is pretty spectacular. It's the most spectacular canyon that I've seen, because I'm from Britain, where you don't have large numbers of big canyons. You know, it's a small island, and I have not, at the time of recording this, seen the Grand Canyon. I know that when I see the Grand Canyon, my jaw is going to drop. Everyone says that, you know, you can't get the idea of it from the photographs. I've been told that, but as of this moment, I've not seen the Grand Canyon. And therefore, the most spectacular canyon I've seen is the Snake Canyon, which is far deeper and bigger than anything I've ever seen in Britain. So that's just a fascinating place. And again, you can see how a post-flood lake retained water breaking away would have caused that damage. Now, the biggest flood other than the biblical flood would have been the one known as the Missoula flood. In the Missoula area of Montana, there would have been a large lake held back by after the flood called Lake Missoula. And again, my God has done a huge amount of research on the subject of Lake Missoula and what's therefore known as the Missoula Flood. And just look at a map of this region of the northwest of the United States, and you'll see the idea. If there was a large lake in Montana, which even secular geologists believe there must have been because of the evidence on the ground, the only things we differ on really are the time scale. So there would have been a large lake there, and a lot of this lake would have been held back by the glaciers that were there. And as the glaciers began to retreat, eventually they would weaken, and eventually Lake Missoula would have broken free and would have flooded westwards. So you had, rushing westwards, an enormous body of floodwater that would have drained the lake in just a couple of days. Literally in just a couple of days. So this floodwater would have run rapidly across where modern day Idaho is, through the area of the Panhandle, and quickly therefore into eastern Washington state. Obviously none of those states existed, but that's the direction the water would have gone. And flowed right across eastern Washington and formed many of these spectacular features you have in eastern Washington. For example, the Grand Coulee. There are a lot of flat-bottomed valleys in eastern Washington, which are known as coulees, and these were probably formed by being carved out by these floodwaters, which are post-floodwaters during the Missoula flood, catastrophically happening. Even secular geologists now accept that this must have happened catastrophically in the space of just a few days. And if they're going to believe that that's a catastrophe that happened, then, you know, why can't they believe the global catastrophe? But the evidence is all there in eastern Washington. So you've got this area in eastern Washington, the Scablands, and the areas where there's water would have rushed through in channels. A friend of mine took me on a trip into this area in the Grand Coulee, showed me one area to the west of the Grand Coulee, near the town of George, and you can see in the rocks where a large whirlpool must have been that's clearly eaten, sort of circular, as it rotated, circulated and ate water, ate what rock away very, very fast. You can see that this sort of thing could only happen at great speed, and then the water pouring over into the Columbia Gorge, the Columbia Valley, Basically, this water would have ended up in the Columbia eventually. And back to the Grand Coulee itself, because this is there were other coulees, was the Moses Coulee, there were other places too. But the biggest coulee of all is the Grand Coulee. It's like Washington's own Grand Canyon, if you like. This amazing flat-bottomed valley. And there's one very spectacular point in the Grand Coulee called the Dry Falls. And, you know, I recognized the appearance of the Dry Falls from what I'd seen at Malham Tarn. Malham Tarn, I said, was a waterfall that's no longer there. Well, you see this in eastern Washington, except that this waterfall is about 4 miles long. It is enormous, but it is dry. If it has still had water flowing over it, it would clearly be much, much bigger than the Niagara Falls. So you can imagine this, and the interpretive boards at the visitor centre overlooking the Dry Falls show artists' impressions of what it must have looked like. And this water would have been rushing over very fast, again, for just a few days. So you've got the evidence of catastrophe there, and you read those interpretive boards, they're saying the same thing. Secular geologists have to believe that this took place over a few days, that the water was pouring over this waterfall and flooding down southwards and eventually ending up in the Columbia River, in the Columbia River Valley. Well, of course, we therefore have to suggest that the Columbia River was already there after the flood. You know, the Columbia River would have formed fairly quickly after the flood. So by the time the Ice Age is ending and the Missoula flood comes through, the Columbia Valley already exists. So this water's flowing down the Columbia River, and it gets to the point where the river is narrow and you have a huge gorge there, the Columbia Gorge, which is just one of the most beautiful places that you can possibly see. I used to love taking visitors into that area when I lived in southwest Washington near Mount St. Helens. When I was running the Mount St. Helens Creation Center, I did sometimes take people a little bit further away than normal into the Columbia Gorge to have a look at the effects of the Missoula flood, which would have been spectacular. There's a sort of dry valley that was like a runoff point, a spill-off point, because some of the water funneling into the gorge would have spilled over and carved this little valley out. There's the most amazing things that you can see, and carved by these floodwaters rushing down the Columbia, and you've got whole hills, little hills, which are basically made of debris that was being pulled down the valley by the running water, and the water would have spilled into the Willamette Valley as well as it's on its way out towards the sea. Huge amounts of damage, if you like, post-flood damage being caused by the Missoula flood. But it's just amazing to see. It's fascinating to look at the evidence there. And you know, you've got hundreds of miles to drive to find those things. So I used to like to take people into the Columbia Gorge so you could see those things. And by the way, in the Columbia Gorge, you also see evidence of the flood itself and what happened at the time of the flood. But you've certainly got this evidence of the Missoula flood, which even secular geologists have to concede was a catastrophic event very, very fast. Well, to summarize all that, all those geological things that you therefore see in eastern Washington state and through Idaho and Montana, these were all catastrophic, rapid events, but they were caused by the spillage of post-flood lakes, areas of flood water that were retained and eventually broke free. And it was really the retreating ice that caused them to break free. So all these things are explained as a result of this ice age happening after the flood. So you've got an ice age lasting some 7 centuries after the flood, and sometime during towards the end of that time, probably about 500 years after the flood, you've got these catastrophic floods like the Lake Idaho outflow, Bonneville, that was the word beginning with V, the Lake Bonneville outflow, and most spectacular of all, the Lake Missoula outflow. These you can therefore explain. I know the secular geologists have their explanation, but it makes sense in a biblical worldview. You've got the worldwide flood, you're clearly going to have retained watery areas, especially since you're probably talking about a time before many human beings and animals have managed to get onto the North American continent, and you've got these geological effects caused by these post-flood floods. And it all makes sense. So the science actually does make sense, starting from a biblical point of view. Now, this doesn't prove the Bible. It's the other way around. We start from the Bible, and therefore we understand the geology that we see. But it's just so wonderful to have groups of people with us looking at things like the Dry Falls, looking at things like the Columbia Gorge, just seeing the effects over hundreds and hundreds of miles of things that can really only be explained as being as a direct result of the after effects of the worldwide flood. So there we have it. I hope that makes some sort of sense. There's a lot more complex science you can go into. And, you know, the Mount St. Helens Creation Centre is still there, it's still going. My good friend Pat Roy runs that centre now. And, you know, if you go and take a trip with him to Mount St. Helens, you see effects of catastrophic damage on a small scale that happened in 1980. And then maybe, you know, you can go and see the Columbia Gorge with people like the Creation Encounters Group and see the effects of the Missoula Flood. Or you can go with other groups and go and see the effects at the Dry Falls. Or you could go to the Lake Missoula area itself and see where the lake surface would have been and the beaches that are now sort of high up on the hillside. So you can see all those effects, and they're all best explained in this one biblical model that the worldwide flood had an effect that caused things to happen after the flood that really are best explained with that starting point, with that biblical starting point. And if the Bible is correct about that, which it is, then the Bible is correct about what it tells you about salvation. The Bible's correct about what it says about sin and God's wrath against sin and God's mercy against sin and forgiveness of sin through the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. So, dig deeper into that science. Read Mike Ward's books about the Missoula Flood and about the Ice Age. And go and visit some of these places where you can actually see the evidence there on the ground. And just thank you for listening to this this podcast. I'm wondering about starting some little trips, maybe beginning next summer from next spring, once next winter's over, maybe doing some creation tours in the areas of North Idaho. So if you are interested in that, why not drop me a line? Fill in one of the forms on the Proverbs1810.org website, and let's start to get a list of people who might be interested in doing creation tours in northern Idaho. Possibly even further afield, I'm wondering about taking people into the Glacier National Park in Montana as well, which is about 3 hours drive from where I am now. If you're interested in those two things, drop me a line, let's build up some lists, and then next summer let's see what we can do about them. Meanwhile, thank you for listening to this podcast. Please remember to support me. I need your support to be able to pay for doing these podcasts. You can do that by going to my Subscribestar page, subscribestar.com/PaulFTaylor. Please have a look at that and sign up there to support my podcast and support my writing of books. And meanwhile, keep your podcasting software up to date so you don't miss next week's episode of the Paul Taylor Podcast.